Listen to us now, live on the ESPN Chicago app. This is Chicago's home for sports. ESPN Chicago.
Jeff Miller, Brian Hanley, hanging out with you until 11 o'clock today here on ESPN 1000. And the headliner is Northwestern and them backpedaling quickly about what exactly the future holds for Pat Fitzgerald right now, who was initially suspended for 2 weeks without pay. That was done on Friday morning, or was it Thursday? I'm trying to remember when exactly that initial suspension came about. Needless to say, though, there has been some reporting done by the Daily Northwestern, the school's student newspaper, that has brought more light to the allegations about hazing under Pat Fitzgerald's watch here. And the Northwestern president, Michael Schill, yesterday, according to reports, sent a letter to the Northwestern community and wrote that, quote, he may have erred in weighing the appropriate sanction for Pat Fitzgerald. Adam Rittenberg has been covering the story for ESPN, and he joins us now here on ESPN 1000, Miller and Hanley. Adam, what are your initial thoughts about what is going on right now at Northwestern?
Yeah, good morning, guys. It's certainly a ongoing, evolving situation from Friday to where we're at right now. And I think there's certainly more to come, because there's going to be meetings today, I'm told, between President Schill and the board and other university leaders, as he's gotten more directly involved in this process. You know, they initially commissioned an outside counsel investigator to do all the interviews and collect information. You know, that process wrapped up late last week. But, you know, now with what the Daily reported and the fact that Schill has reached out to the initial whistleblower, who I, in full disclosure, just spoke to, he told me he also did speak with the president directly. And so, you know, now there's a face to it. Now there's details to it. And obviously the response has changed from the initial 2 week suspension of Coach Fitzgerald on Friday to a reassessment of what happened and what could be coming.
And Adam, when the president of the university, Michael Schill, says that initially he focused too much on what the report concluded that Fitzgerald didn't know and not enough on what he should have known. And as the head coach of one of our athletic programs, Coach Fitzgerald is not only responsible for what happens within the program, but also must take great care to uphold our and maintain our commitment to the student experience. It is, and Pat Fitzgerald put out his own statement saying that he was unaware of the allegations and any incidents that did occur. Can you hold the football coach of any program to account for things he truly didn't know, and is ignorance a defense here?
Yeah, I think it's a harder and harder defense, Brian. You know, if you're to believe, you know, what the former player came out with, and in talking with him, how widespread he said this behavior was, and how many people were involved. That, you know, it was a large group of upperclassmen who led the quote unquote running the hazing that would take place in the locker room. And, you know, again, according to him, you know, he believes that Fitzgerald would have these hand signals that would trigger, you know, a player to be put on this list to be hazed, you know, probably a little bit later on. They had these certain times of year that this kind of took place. And so, again, the investigators did not find enough evidence that that proved that Coach Fitzgerald or any of the staff members were aware. But, you know, to kind of to your point, if it was this many people for this many years, where does the buck stop? And it often does stop with the head coach of the program. And so, and, you know, that's why there's obviously a closer look being taken. I think the hard part here is that, you know, there wasn't new information that came out in the Daily Northwestern, at least in Northwestern circles, because this individual who I just spoke to said all of this to the investigators. So maybe it wasn't presented the right way, or maybe the president, you know, didn't receive all the details that he needed to receive, or maybe you had to wait until there was a public backlash for them to look at it in a different light. So that's obviously taking place now, and we'll see where it leads. But I would imagine some decisions are going to be made here relatively soon.
Adam Rittenberg, who's doing a great job covering this story about Northwestern and the suspension of Pat Fitzgerald amidst the hazing allegations. Adam, I found that fascinating, you saying that you spoke with the whistleblower and that he or she revealed to you that they made this information known to the investigation. Like, immediately my thought is, okay, well, when you have an internal investigation, even if you bring in outside counsel, the truth is that you as the entity tasking the investigation to be at hand here, you can basically dictate the terms of what you want to find out, right? Like, that is really, really damning to me to hear you say that the whistleblower made it known to the investigators that this was the case.
Right. And again, I haven't talked to the investigators. They likely would not share any details of those conversations. But this person was very detailed. They were prepared. And, you know, they told me when they first reached out to Northwestern's compliance office. They told me the date of the interview with Maggie Hickey and one of her associates. They told me about the communication that they had after that point. So this was a very coordinated person in terms of what they presented to that group. And so, you know, again, that's where this is. And I asked him, I mean, say, why do you think it was only a 2-week suspension after they knew all that information? And again, maybe it was because they didn't get enough verification from other players. You know, certainly there were denials from the coaching staff. There's obviously a lot of support still for that culture and for Coach Fitzgerald. But this person's point to me was, of course, they're going to be supportive because they were either engaged in it or they were standing by while it was going on. And again, in the summary that came out Friday, there was no individuals named, even though there was you know, clearly stated in there that the allegations were corroborated. There wasn't anyone singled out other than again the 2-week suspension for a coach who was not proven to have known what had happened in the program.
And I'll speak for myself. Most people who've been around Pat Fitzgerald, very surprised that he would be implicated in any of it, whether it's to deny that he had any knowledge that this was going on under his supervision. But the fact is, here's where we are with him. And I was saying, I go back to Randy Walker when you were a student journalist at Northwestern, Adam. And Randy Walker would always say, well, it's not a democracy around here. You know, if you asked him what the players thought about something, every college football coach I ever covered, or most everyone, believed that they were the czar, and there was no wiggle room on that. They believed they knew everything about their program, and no one was going to tell them otherwise. So you really can't have it both ways. You can't believe that. And by the way, two of the sanctions initially from the university was no more Kenosha training camp, because basically they're saying we can't trust you to be up there with a coaching staff that has question marks. And we're going to have a locker room monitor that won't report to the football staff, will report to the university administration. How does that even work? I mean, basically you're telling me you don't trust the coaching staff anymore.
Right, and you know just as well as I do, Brian, how that locker room is a sacred place, and you don't want anyone in there
Absolutely.
Who is unaffiliated with the coaching staff or with the team. And you know, again, these incidents, these alleged incidents, took place in the locker room. I was told by the whistleblower earlier today that really no staff were in there. Obviously, when they took place, the lights were off. It was a kind of a very scary type of situation, especially for those who were going through it. So you know, again, that was sort of an underreported, there wasn't much attention on those other penalties, but that's certainly something that's going to affect this team going forward, to have somebody in that room who is essentially an outsider.
We also, Adam Rittenberg joining us here on ESPN 1000. Adam, we also earlier played the video, the old video that surfaced back from 2014 when Pat Fitzgerald talked about having a zero tolerance policy for hazing. Do you think now that, you know, living in the age of social media that we live in, do you think that having that out there will in any way expedite a possible termination for him?
I think the question is ultimately what they believe he knew of this. You know, this whistleblower who I spoke to was very clear in saying he believes that that there was an absolute cause and effect that from this clapping that would go on at practice to people getting put on a whiteboard in the locker room, and then they were then hazed at different points of the year before the season. They did it on Thanksgiving Day. I guess they did it on Christmas before the bowl game. So kind of very odd times of the year. So, it depends if there needs to be more investigation, if in conversations directly between the president and this player and his family, they now believe something different about Pat and his knowledge. But I think that, again, the tricky thing is you did an investigation, you completed the investigation, and you determined that the head coach, was not aware. You could not prove he had enough awareness of what had happened. So I don't know how you necessarily go back on that.
And you always have to, there's always a money element component to all of this stuff. And Pat just signed reportedly a contract extension for 10 years in 2021. We'll reportedly pay him $57 million when it's all said and done. We know he's the youngest football coach when he took over for Randy Walker after Randy passed. Everyone believed that Pat Fitzgerald, as long as he wanted to stay in Evanston, would stay in Evanston. And anytime there were talks of Michigan or the Chicago Bears making entrees or rumors or whispers to Pat, he got rewarded. And meanwhile, he's barely over 500 in 17 years, which I guess at Northwestern some people still celebrate. But the last few years haven't been great on the field either.
They haven't. I mean, last year was the worst record since 1989. Really the still the dark ages for the program. He's the winningest coach in team history. He's done overall a very good job. And you take out, you look at 2007 to 2018, that's the most consistent stretch of successful football in modern history at Northwestern. But lately it has been rough. And now you have this, going into the 2023 season, just weeks away from the start of preseason practice. So the timing is not great, but from what I know in covering the sport, and I know you have for years too, Brian, it's very difficult to fire coaches for cause, especially after you've done an investigation. And so I think, no matter how this turns out,
whoever might be interested in taking that job doesn't want to be walking away without a dime in his pocket. You always have to cut a check, whether you believe that's right morally or ethically or any other way. It's what the future is going to hold and what the market's going to hold, and how did you treat the guy on the way out the door?
For absolutely, and certainly from a performance standpoint, you could make a case there. I think that the challenging thing here is that the program has really been known for having a very upstanding culture. Mm-hmm. Northwestern doesn't have a lot of guys arrested, a lot of guys that get in trouble. And if these allegations, which have been corroborated to a degree, but maybe more so in the coming days, it really stains the overall all program and what's been built there. If this many people were involved in this type of behavior, and so many people were subjected to it and afraid to come forward, it's a black eye. So we'll see where it goes from here, but it's certainly a very delicate time right now at Northwestern.
Yeah, Adam, just to wrap us up here, that's, I think, the key point here. For a long time, Pat Fitzgerald, Brian brings up his record, a little bit over 500 in his career. But, oftentimes the university could put Pat Fitzgerald up, who was clearly the face of this organization, for, there was obviously a period of time where he wasn't with, but from 1995 as the captain of the team that went to the Rose Bowl and was, the biggest success story in this city in terms of college football for a long, long time, and probably still is. They were that tie that linked to that magical season, and then to have him as your face for so long, you could sometimes look at the record and say, okay, maybe they're not going to necessarily be able to compete with Ohio State, but oftentimes they could put the university up on a pedestal and say, our student athletes are truly students. But now if you've got this, this black mark on your resume, I don't really know how you continue to go forward with Pat Fitzgerald.
Yeah, I think a lot of people have brought that up, and what he's meant to the program, but also what's come out lately, and what could still be coming out going forward. It's a very difficult situation, one that certainly nobody who loves Northwestern football wants to be in, but it's the reality here. The fact that, again, a lot of this was corroborated, even though it was just the single individual who came forward. in November. And even though the team is obviously still supportive, given the statement that came out yesterday, it's certainly a difficult situation and one that, I'm with you. I think a lot of people think it's hard to look at that program and say, and see Pat Fitzgerald coaching them in the fall and for many years to come in light of what's happened here in the last few days.
One quick one. We'll let you go, Adam. Appreciate your time as always. If the Daily Northwestern hadn't written that initial story, would we have even known that there was an internal investigation and they found what they found, and would there have been sanctions, and would they have been sanctions that weren't made public?
No, I mean, that they announced the investigation back in January, and obviously they announced the findings on Friday. So I think that part of it all obviously would have been out.
But the details, the graphic details.
Sure. I mean, I think again, it was incumbent on the whistleblower, on this former player, to come forward as he has to the Daily and to me today, and provide, you know, details and information that are pretty damning, honestly. Even though it is, you know, just him, he told me there's a lot more players who feel this way or have been through this, and we'll see if they also corroborate the story. And some of them already did with the investigators. So I think if those details don't come out though, I think it's whatever happened Friday, and they move forward, and he's back on the job in a couple weeks.
Plenty more details to come involving this story. Clearly, Adam Rittenberg is all over it for ESPN. Adam, thanks so much for joining us today. We appreciate it, man.
Okay, thanks. Appreciate that.
Thanks, Adam.
Adam Rittenberg covering college athletics for ESPN. He's a senior writer for ESPN.com. He's been there a long time, and as Brian mentioned, also an alum of Northwestern who worked at the Daily Northwestern.
I used to sit next to him at football and basketball games. Always knew Adam was going to make a name for himself in this business, and he has.
Yeah, so he would clearly be all over the story. As you mentioned, it was great to get him on because he's talked with the whistleblower just within the last hour or so. So great to hear that perspective as we continue to cover this ongoing story here on ESPN 1000. I'm Jeff Meller. He's Brian Hanley, hanging out with you till 11 on ESPN 1000.
This is Chicago's home for sports. ESPN Chicago. Listen now in HD on our app and on ESPN 1000.
Andrew Vaughn, the hitter. First pitch swinging. Belted in the left. This one's going to go. 4-3 White Sox, two home runs in the inning. Andrew Vaughn gives the Sox the lead.
Connor McKnight on the call of Andrew Vaughn's last homer, I believe it was back in early June maybe, when Andrew Vaughn homered for the 12th time on the season. We were talking a little bit about the Major League Baseball draft and what you can actually expect when your team makes a player their first round pick. And I'll tell you, Bri, Andrew Vaughn is somebody who, he was selected third overall in 2019, was regarded as the, for the most part, the best hitter in that draft. And he was, I think, because of the hopes for a championship window and the, again, lack of depth in the White Sox organization, he was forced into action back in 2021, where he was playing, you know, outfield, and that was, you know, he did a serviceable job, but you have to wonder if that maybe, you know, they expedited his trip to the majors, and you wonder if it was maybe done at the expense of his development as a hitter at the minor league levels, because he's arrived and he's been fine. He currently has an OPS of 759. He's got 12 homers, 53 RBIs. You know, I believe, Luis Robert finally passed him in RBIs because he's been on fire over the last couple of weeks. But, you know, he's been a productive hitter. But when you draft a guy third overall,
you want more than a productive hitter.
Well, especially when he's regarded as the best hitter in that draft.
And by the way, I agreed with certainly at the time saying farewell to Jose Abreu because you wanted to get Andrew Vaughn at first base and get him comfortable and see those numbers start going up and on a more consistent basis, see what the ceiling is. Because you think you knew what the ceiling, you thought you had an idea what the ceiling was, and he was going to be able to reach it more quickly if he was at his natural position, not playing on the outfield. But yeah, third overall pick, you expect more consistency, you expect better. The numbers aren't bad, and relative to the rest of the team, they're actually very good. But when you have a team that still has the lack of the highest swing rate and the least number of pitches seen per plate appearance in the American League, and that's been an issue, getting on base. on-base percentage. So when you do finally hit a home run, it's usually a solo home run. It begs the question, is it the approach? Is it the roster architect, the type of player you're drafting and developing? Are you developing said players? Is it even the new coaching staff not getting the message across to them? We talked about it a week or so ago. You did White Sox Weekly, and they had the high padding up around for batting practice around the mound so that guys would mentally see a barrier and try to lift the ball in the air because they're a ground ball hitting team. And for a few games, it seemed to translate. But when you aren't patient at the plate, you're not getting on base, and yet now the home runs, are other than Luis Robert, where are they coming from on a regular basis? The answer really nowhere. I mean, how do you change it? Is it an organizational problem? Is it simply a frustration problem? Guys are just up there trying to do anything because of the way the team has gone south, not only this year but last year. So now they don't want to be patient. They don't want to wait for the pitch. Anything close, they're going to try to drive, and the end result usually isn't that they're driving the ball.
It's hard to win baseball games consistently in 2023 when your lineup is littered with players who don't take walks. And sure, if I have a guy who takes a walk like Andrew Benintendi, the occasional walk, who you're paying a premium for, by the way, the highest contract in the organization's history, who doesn't homer, well, then that's not necessarily a great balance. I need a guy who can exhibit power at the plate but also have patience where he can command the strike zone, work a pitcher, and draw the occasional walk. The reason time and time again the White Sox are hitting solo home runs is because they don't draw walks on a consistent basis. Sure, I know the rallying cry a lot of times for people who want to see they wanted to see their team play small ball, right? Like get the single, get a couple runners on base.
Get them on, get them over, get them in.
But again, it's a different era of baseball. It's much harder to do to string together three consecutive hits. And oftentimes, that's what you need to do is string together three consecutive hits if you're going to drive in a run. Because single, unless you have some really aggressive base running, which, by the way, that's also been a Achilles heel by this White Sox team is the base running, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's very difficult to string together three consecutive hits. So if you're not going to string together three consecutive singles to drive in a run, then you probably need to draw a walk from time to time. And the White Sox can't do that. So, yeah, it's very difficult in this age of baseball to single. And then it's also, if you want to score some more runs, it'd be nice to have some guys on base. So draw a walk if you can't hit those singles. And they have accumulated a bunch of hitters who can't really do that at the major league level at a high level of success.
And yesterday was a prime example of that. You have four singles in 95 pitches thrown to the Chicago White Sox, and two of those were back-to-back in the ninth inning.
Yeah.
Against Miles Mikolas. I mean, it wasn't exactly who will not be punching up his Hall of Fame speech anytime soon, right?
And by the way, one of the few guys in baseball who's in a starting rotation who doesn't strike out a lot of hitters.
Right.
Like, he pitches to contact. So, yeah, when you get, you know what I mean? Like, you got four hits against Miles Mikolas. That's one of the guys in the league who you don't necessarily have to worry about striking out against. You can actually put the ball in play. I think it all comes back to two. When you don't want to spend money, like, that's fine. We can all point to the Tampa Bay Rays, but if you're not doing things at their level, then it's a foolish errand to just try and sell your fan base and say, we're going to win, because we're going to be smarter than the rest of baseball. Clearly they're not. Whether, Luis Robert, for all his strides that he's made, again, he doesn't really draw a whole lot of walks. And so he's your best player. And I think I'd say he's basically lived up to all the hype that you could have hoped for when you look at this season and the way it's playing out. He's as good as you could have realistically expected him to be when you brought him in, and everybody around him is not doing their job.
Well, speaking of the Tampa Rays, if I'm Jed or Rakan, I'm on the phone. Lucas Giolito is going to get dealt to some team. They finally hit some adversity here. What, 6-7 game losing streak?
Seven in a row,
right,
for the Rays.
And as they head into the last game before the break, they need at least one starting pitcher. So
yes.
Giolito, Marcus Stroman, they still have a pretty stocked farm system, and they're going to go for it this year. And they might want to, their phone's going to be ringing, or they're going to be making phone calls on the GM cell phone. And I would hope that the the Chicago is well represented in those calls.
Lucas Giolito makes a start today for the White Sox at Guaranteed Rate Field. First pitch at 1:10. We'll have your pregame coverage coming your way at 12:30 today. Lucas Giolito up against Steven Matz. Listen, every time Lucas Giolito goes out and pitches, it could theoretically be his last start for the White Sox. So it's something certainly to keep an eye on. I'm sure I'd be surprised if today was his last start because the White Sox seem to want to claim.
Could be his last start at home, for sure.
Oh, definitely.
Because they
definitely
end up, they open up on the road, a very tough schedule coming out of the All-Star break.
But I always say, too, the team that is willing sometimes to go ahead and make a deal a little bit before the trade deadline starts, and oftentimes we'll see the first big deal come right out of the All-Star break when teams have kind of like made peace with where they're
and
at.
And they're also talking through the, in Seattle for the next couple days.
So just be aware, White Sox fans, that every time Lucas Giolito does go to the mound, it could be his last for the White Sox. 312-332-3776 if you want to talk with us. Mel and Hanley hanging out with you. Up next, man, there is an exciting young player in baseball who just keeps doing something amazing every time he seems to step on the field. We'll let you hear what he did yesterday here on ESPN 1000.
If you missed something, get the podcast on the ESPN Chicago app. This is ESPN Chicago, Chicago's home for sports.
So the Cubs split a four-game series with the Milwaukee Brewers earlier this week. And, you know, I know a lot of
weird way to do it.
It was absolutely.
Up 6-0.
It felt like after the first game and then into the second game, it was like, oh, boy, the Cubs are that final nail in their coffin for the season is going to be done here. And then
they bounce back on the second game.
Yes, to come back. And then they end up coughing it up in that fourth game where you're like, oh, okay, you could have taken 3 of 4.
And you needed to, by the way.
Yeah.
And not only could you have, you should have, or you needed to anyway.
But, meanwhile, while you were squaring off with the Brewers, the Reds just go ahead and keep on doing some odd things. Man, they have now won. It is 6 of their last 7 and 9 of their last 11, Bri. They're continuing to find ways to win without, it seems like, any real pitching to speak of. And
they have they're a negative run differential, -8, even though they're 50-40. They're doing it on the road, 27-19. Mm-hmm. They're a couple games over .500 at their own ballpark. And against, you know, better than .500 teams, they're 21-22. And, you know, a few weeks ago, I'm like, oh, they're going to come back to earth at some point. So even when the Cubs had that little spurt before they went to London, and, you know, the Reds keep hitting the accelerator, or at least maintaining a winning record going 7 or 8 out of 10. And they need pitching. And they're not, again, not doing the traditional way. They're not protecting their home field. They're doing it on the road. It's a weird division. Maybe it's just a weird year.
So, and I said they've won 9 of their last 11. Remember, that comes on the heels of a 3-game losing streak. But prior to that, they had won 12 in a row.
Yeah.
And honestly, if you look at their schedule and results, the only two that they lost in that little stretch there were to, you know, that were the Braves. The Braves beat them 7-6. For consecutive games after they had won 12 in a row. And oh, by the way, if you haven't noticed, the
Braves stand in line. Everyone
loses
to the Braves.
Are ridiculous. And you know, maybe we don't pay close enough attention to what they are because we're so locked in on the Central divisions from time to time. But if you haven't noticed, the Atlanta Braves are absurd. They are 60-28, and they've got a run differential plus 153, Brian. If they score 5 runs today, they will have 500 on the season, which would be behind only the Texas Rangers. And the crazy thing is for the Braves, they basically have every significant piece in their lineup and in their rotation locked up to a long-term deal.
Unbelievable. I mean, you can just call the division right now because Miami's 9.5 back, but And there go the Mets with their, $350 million payroll.
Yes.
Sitting just above in between the Nationals and the Phillies.
Yes.
And unfortunately, Phillies are playing better. I'd put a preseason wager on them as a World Series contender to be in the,
yes,
World Series, not necessarily
to win the pennant. Yeah,
win the pennant. Doesn't look too good right now. But yeah, it's just, it's a weird year, but boy, Atlanta just loaded and hey. just nothing stops them.
Well, yeah. And Ronald Acuna has figured out the whole, pitch clock and using it to his benefit because he's an awesome hitter, but like for stolen bases, like nobody can seem to throw him out. He has 21 homers and what is this, like 35 steals now? I haven't checked in a couple days, but he's on pace for like 40-70, Bri. He's got 41 steals. My apologies. He's got 41 steals.
In 88 games.
Yeah. So just keep an eye on him. He's been overshadowed a little bit by Shohei Ohtani this season. But one player who I don't think has been overshadowed since he has been called up to the major leagues is Elly De La Cruz of the Cincinnati Reds. And man, oh man, like it seems like he does something exciting every time he steps on the field. And if you missed it yesterday, how about this? He stole three bases in two pitches. This is courtesy of Bally Sports Ohio in Cincinnati.
0-2 again. Line beyond the Thomas base hit. Friedel scores the Reds' first lead on the bat of Elly De La Cruz. De La Cruz goes. Pitch called a strike. Throw down on a skip late. Another steal. He takes off again. Pitch down and in. Fade throw. There's no chance. Two steals.
De La Cruz had already looked a couple of times at Brian Anderson, knowing that if he got a job.
Hey, wait a minute.
The throw. He stole home. The most thrilling man in baseball stole second, third, and home.
Brian, he made it look like they were little leaguers out there.
Yeah.
That's what the best kid does on the little league field is he coaxes the team into throwing the ball back to the pitcher. And as the catcher just softly tosses it back to the pitcher, he takes off for home.
You just
and
heard
steals
that,
home.
I mean, the Bally Sports crew, they're just, oh, okay, that the play's over. Let's talk a little bit. Oh, hey, he's going home.
It was awesome. If you haven't seen it, check out the video because he is just, you know, a player. I think I was talking to Len Casper when I was doing White Sox Weekly a couple weeks ago, and I mentioned to him, like, that's one thing when a new, young, exciting player comes up, I can never get enough of them. I remember the last time I felt like I do about Elly De La Cruz was probably with Fernando Tatis Jr.
Absolutely.
Right? Like, just a player who you haven't seen before but comes in and immediately is a great player.
You might have seen him in the Sox organization if you looked really hard. Ah, big game, James. Worked out well. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's all good. It's all good.
What might have been? What might have been? Let's try Ray. Ray, you're on with Hanley and Miller. What's going on, man? You want to talk about the Braves a little bit here?
Yeah, I was wondering, how are the Braves able to survive without Swanson at shortstop? You know, he's such a great player. Mm. How are they doing good? And last year, the Astros lost Correa and Springer and won the World Series.
Interesting, huh?
How do these teams do this?
Listen, it's good.
Takes more than one.
It's great scouting by the organization, and it's an interesting point, right? Like Dansby Swanson, I think the Cubs have been happy with what they've gotten from him, right?
Yeah.
But he also was one of the few players, as I mentioned, who the Braves didn't really feel the need to go out and lock up to a long term deal. They were in conversations with him,
but they weren't going to overpay.
Because
they're look at the organizational chart and say, you know, we'll be okay. I mean, you would in a perfect world love to have you stick around. But yeah, I love the sarcasm from our caller Ray.
How
could they possibly be doing this?
They've locked up Sean Murphy, Matt Olson, Ozzie Albies, Austin Riley, Michael Harris, and Ronald Acuna. That is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 of the main hitters in their lineup. They have locked up to long term deals, and they also signed Spencer Strider this season to a long term deal. The ace of their staff. So basically the foundation of a team that is the best in baseball right now with a bunch of young players, young and exciting players, is locked up for a long, long time for the Braves.
Scary stuff.
Yeah, so it is not great. The only good thing I'll say is if you are a baseball fan, Ray, is that you can look at, you know, the Major League Baseball playoffs. It is the playoffs which is the most random, right? Like you get 3- and 5-game series where, you know, anything can kind of happen in a one-off for baseball. And so that's why, you know, as good as the Braves are, you get to the playoffs, and that's why you always heard Theo Epstein talk about it, right? Like, just get to the playoffs and hopefully you kind of get lucky at the right time. Your hitters are going well. Your pitchers are going well. Baseball is the one random sport or the sport where it's most random in the playoffs. And so I think that's probably, if you're a team who's not in the NL East, that's the one thing you can cling to, is that maybe we can get real lucky against the Braves in a short series.
If you have at least two or three starters and you get in, then that's that gives you a leg up usually in a series if you have three guys you can count on.
So we got some good news in the city for a longtime colleague who Brian and I both know well. Want to mention that coming up next. And also the NBA the NBA midseason tournament. What do we think about that? We'll chat about it next here on ESPN 1000.
This is Chicago's home for sports. ESPN Chicago. Listen now in HD on our app and on ESPN 1000.
Jeff Mellor, Brian Hanley, hanging out with you till 11 o'clock here today on ESPN 1000. Again, White Sox pregame coverage starts at 12:30 today as they conclude the first half of the baseball season against the Cardinals at Guaranteed Rate Field. Lucas Giolito up against Steven Matz, first pitch at 1:10.
No 9 inches of rain today, so they'll get that one in. They'll have a window.
Yeah, we were last week previewing the Grand Park 220, which I have to say, Bri, I'm not a NASCAR guy at all, but it was entertaining, at least for a one-off for me. I enjoyed it. I watched more, almost the entire race.
I did too, and I was watching with friends and none of us NASCAR people, and 4th of July, everyone's hanging out, doing their, and you know, 9 inches of rain will keep you inside, yes. But I just asked you during the break. I'm not sure. They're here for two more years as long as both sides agree. I guess there's as long as one side wants to bow out 6 months before the race, they can pull the plug, and people are saying it wasn't worth the effort for the city and they didn't benefit from it. But
yes,
I don't know I'd watch it a second time, but I watched almost the entirety of it last week, and I know they're going to talk about changing the course because those at 35, 40 mile an hour there, someone was always in the pile of tires. And,
yes.
You know, a little help. Need a little help here. So I don't know I'd watch it in year two or three. But it was interesting. It was a spectacle, I suppose.
Yeah, I had an argument with my son. My 13-year-old was like, why aren't they going faster? And I said, well, they're professional drivers, Alex. Chances are they recognize that if they go any faster, they're going to crash. And he just looked back at me, and this is what it's like arguing with a 13-year-old. He said, I'm pretty sure they can go faster.
They're professional.
And I just shrugged my shoulders, and I said, okay. You go, when you get your driver's license, you go give it a try, buddy. But yeah, for a one-off, I enjoyed it. I'm not sure, though, I will watch much more of it in the future if they return. And definitely, it would probably be, if they do have come back next year, it'd be better to probably give them a little more course to actually pick up the speed a little bit.
So then go faster.
Yes.
So we can all be impressed by how fast they are capable of going.
All right. So the NBA is looking to generate some interest like NASCAR did with their streetcar race. They are officially going to go through with the in-season tournament. And Brian, you were trying to explain to me the groups and format for
I was trying to explain to myself. I read through it about 10 times. All it can do is boil it down because there are so many ends and widths, and then therefore this team will do that.
Pot 1, pot 3, pot 4.
There's groups of five, and those will be your regular season games, 81, 82. If you're really interested, go try to discern exactly what the Final Four is in Vegas in November or early December, right?
Yep. Yes.
And there's money, a nice pot of money, $500,000 to each player on the winning team. I guess. Are you telling me the regular season's already dull in November, and so you needed to juice this thing? Or you just couldn't do it in February because the All-Star game and you have trade deadline and everything else. You just had to squeeze it in somewhere. But it's based on kind of the soccer model, European soccer model, right?
Correct. So, yeah, the NBA Cup, as I believe it's going to be officially called, in soccer, in the top leagues across Europe, essentially every league has its own individual tournament, which happens. The only difference, I guess, would be in soccer versus what they're attempting to do here in basketball is it essentially these in-season tournaments that happen in soccer, they run concurrently as the league's happening. There's not like a stoppage where they go and play these. What happens is these tournaments occur during the season. But
and this will, too. The initial rounds will be on specified days. Regular season games will just be designated as tournament games, but they'll also be regular season, count for the regular season record until they get to Las Vegas. Then you'd have a...
So it's, you know, it's a little different in that regard. But nevertheless, like, I from a soccer perspective, when I look at it, what I can tell people is that the nice thing about these in-season tournaments for soccer is that it gives other clubs an opportunity to win something. And in soccer, where oftentimes it's very, you know, the top five or six teams in each league are heavily favored, and it's very difficult for them not to win their leagues. It gives other teams something to play for. And ultimately, the fan bases or the supporters of the clubs, they do really revel when their team wins one of these trophies. And I think... with some time, I think the NBA, you know, I think some it'll give your, you know, if the Bulls go and win this in-season tournament, it will never like replace or you know, be on par with an NBA championship. But I do think there will be, I think it will bring some fan bases a little bit of interest and some joy to see, hey, we remember that year we won the tournament. It'll give you something to look back on, and it'll, It's a trophy for the trophy case, I guess. But I think fan bases will find some. They'll find some reason to kind of like garner some support around it.
Hey, when Lonzo's back for that, I'm all on the Bulls bandwagon.
Okay,
yeah, I'm counting on it. So you heard it here. They got a great shot because I think he's coming back. What?
So it's something to celebrate. Ultimately, it will never be as good as an NBA championship, but I think it'll be for, you know, this couple-week period where they have the group stage and then eventually the finals or whatever. I think it'll give teams a little more interest because, listen, one and done, that in itself always is – it brings that extra added element of, you know, do or die that you don't have all the
sure.
time. So.
Well, I mean, look, it gives the Bulls one more thing to aspire to, right? It might be our only thing, you know. Hey, maybe they're hot going into that four-week period or so.
We did want to mention, too, a longtime colleague, Harry Tynowitz, got some great news regarding him in the last couple weeks.
Yeah, he's recovering Northwestern Hospital. If you follow him on Twitter, you see he keeps you up to date. He's getting great care. He's in really good spirits. It's so good to see a really good guy. He got his transplant.
Yeah, liver transplant.
And he's back to being airy and even making jokes about people. Hey, people said I was really yellow. Was I yellow? I mean, he's even laughing at a very dire situation, which is now a very optimistic situation. So our best to Harry and his family, and everyone's helping him out at Northwestern Hospital. Also, it's my brother Bernie's birthday today, big 65. So happy birthday. One of my other brothers... texting at him, Social Security and ARP.
Big
and,
B-Day.
Yeah, and discounts, senior discounts for everything, early bird specials. It's a milepost birthday for my brother.
All right, good stuff. Happy birthday, Bernie Hanley. Thanks to Jake Cantu for producing this morning. We appreciate it, Jake, as always. And thanks to you, Brian, for making things easy today.
Yeah, it's fun. As always, we'll talk next week.
Sounds good. All right, he's Brian Hanley. I'm Jeff Meller. Don't forget White Sox pregame coverage coming up at 12:30 as the White Sox conclude the first half of the season against the Cardinals. First pitch coming your way at 1:10. Thanks for listening, folks. I'm Jeff Meller. He's Brian Hanley. This is ESPN 1000.